Success Live with the Reverend Donald Gordon Carty, Ph.D.
Segment 9, The Will to Fail and Writing the Direction by Dorothea Brown. The Will to Fail by Dorothea Brand, from her book Wake Up and Live. From the disciples of Schopenhauer and Freud, of Nietzsche and Adler, we have all become conversant with such phrases as the will to live and the will to power. These phrases, representing, sometimes to the verge of overstatement, drives of the organism towards fulfillment and growth, correspond to truths of experience with which each of us are familiar. We have seen children struggle to make themselves and their personalities felt. As young people, we have contended for a chance to try our own emerging forces. After long illness, we have felt the tide of returning strength in our veins. We know that any average man caught in unfortunate circumstances will put up with poverty, distress, humiliation, with conditions which an onlooker will sometimes consider as much worse than death, and that only the presence of a will to continue living can account for the tenacity with which a man in such circumstances clings to the mere right to breathe and exist. Furthermore, we first experience and then later turn to realize the process of growth in ourselves. The individual emerges from childhood into adolescence, from adolescence into maturity, and at each of these crises, we find that the activities and interests of the old period are being replaced by those of the new, that nature is preparing the organism for its new role in the world, is actually reconciling us to the new demands on us by showing us pleasures and rewards in the oncoming state which will replace those we must abandon. But the idea of another will, a counterbalancing will, the will to fail, the will to death, is not so readily accepted. For a while it was one of the tenets of psychoanalysis, for instance, that no individual could actually imaginatively encompass the idea that he might cease to be. Even the death dreams and suicide threats of deeply morbid patients were held to be grounded solely in ideas of revenge. The explanation was that the patient thought of himself as living on, invisible, but able to see the remorse and regret caused by his death in those by whom he thought himself ill-treated. Freud, indeed, analyzing shell-shock patients after the war, issued a monograph in which he stated that he had occasionally found dreams that indicate sincere death wishes. This monograph is full of some of the best of Freud's speculations and suggestions. But as for the appearance in popular psychologies of the idea that there could logically be a deathward current running through our lives, it is as though the thesis had never been suggested. Yet death is as much a fact of experience as birth and growth. And if nature prepares us for each new phase of life by closing off old desires and opening new vistas, it does not seem too difficult to think that we are, always, being slowly, gently reconciled to our eventual relinquishment of all we hold dear as living creatures. And withdrawal from struggle, abandonment of effort, releasing of desire and ambition would be normal movements in an organism which was being gently wooed away from its preoccupation with life. It is for this reason that we are entitled to look upon the will to fail as a reality. Now, if inertia, timorousness, substitute activity, effortless effort, quiescence, and resignation were found only at the end of life, or when we were drained by sickness or fatigue, if they never handicapped us when we should be in full flood of our vital powers, there would be no reason at all for attacking this will to fail as if it were, as indeed it is, the arch enemy of all that is good and effective in us. But when it appears in youth or full maturity, it is as symptomatic of something wrong, deeply, internally wrong, with one's life as untimely drowsiness is symptomatic of ordinary bodily ill health. And if it were easily seen for the black-hearted villain it is, when it arrives out of its due time, it would be easy to fight. But almost always we are all well within its power before we do more than suspect rarely and vaguely that all is not as it should be with us. We are so accustomed to speak of failure, frustration, timidity as negative things, that it is like being invited to fight windmills when we are urged to fight the symptoms of failure. In youth, we seldom recognize the symptoms in ourselves. We explain our reluctance to getting started as the natural timidity of the tyro. But the reluctance stays, the years go, and we wake in dismay to find that what was once a charming youthful diffidence in us is now something quite different, sickly and repellent. Or we find a convenient domestic situation to bear the brunt of excusing us for never having got to work in earnest. We could not leave this or that relatively lonely and defenseless. Then the family grows, scatters, and we are left alone. The substitute activity at which we had been so busy is taken remorselessly away from us, and we are sick and terrified at the idea of turning back to take up the long-abandoned plans. Or we have the best of all reasons for not doing as well as we might. Most of us are under the necessity of choosing between work and starvation and the employment we were able to find when it was imperative that we should begin earning is not work for which we are ideally suited. When marriage and the raising of a family have been undertaken, the necessity is all the more urgent. We might be willing to wait through a few thin years if no one but ourselves would suffer, but to ask others to do so takes more selfishness and more courage than most of us can muster. Especially in America, where marriages for love are the rule, most young people start out in their married life with little more than their health, youth, and intelligence as capital. We are accustomed to think of the European idea of asking a dower, from the bride's family as somehow lowly, unworthy, and mercenary. Yet insisting on that little reserve fund of money with which to meet the demands of establishing a new household has much to recommend it. And the fact that we have no such custom in this country may be one reason why America, the much-vaunted land of opportunity, can show so many men and women of middle age wasting themselves in drudgery, filling positions which bring them no joy, and looking forward to a future which at its happiest promise years of monotony, and its worst the nightmare of poverty-ridden unemployment. This necessity to fall upon this first work we can find is alone enough to explain why so few of us ever manage to bring our plans to fruition. Often at first, we have a firm intention of not losing sight of our real goal, in spite of the fact that we must make a living at uncongenial work. We plan to keep an eye on our ambitions and to work at them by hook or crook, evenings, weekends, on vacations. But the 9-to-5 work is tiring and exacting. It takes superhuman strength of character to go on working alone when the rest of the world is at play, and when we have never had any evidence that we should be successful if we continued anyway. And so, without realizing it, we are swept into the current of the will to fail. We are still moving, and we do not see that our motion is downstream. Most of us disguise our failure in public. We disguise it in most successfully from ourselves. It is not hard to ignore the fact that we are doing much less than we were able to do, for very little of what we had planned, even modestly, to accomplish before a certain age, and never, probably, all that we had hoped. One reason it is so easy to deceive ourselves is that somewhere along the way we seemed silently to enter into a sort of gentleman's agreement with our friends and acquaintances. Don't mention my failure to me, we tactfully plead, and I will never let the hint that you are not doing quite all I should expect of you cross my lips. This tactful silence is seldom broken in youth or in the early middle years. Until then, the convention is that at any moment we may get into our stride. A little later, and the silence is relaxed. There comes a time when it is safe to smile ruefully and admit that the hopes we went out to meet the world with were too high and much too rosy, particularly those hopes we had held for our own performance. In the 50s, and sometimes earlier, it is usually safe enough to do a little disarming and semi-humorous grumbling. After all, few of our contemporaries are in the same position to say, "Why can't you start now?" And yet some of the greatest work in the world, many of the world's irreplaceable masterpieces, were done by men and women well past what we too superficially consider their prime. So we slip through the world without making our contribution, without discovering all that there is in us to do, without using the most minute fraction of our abilities, either native or acquired. If we manage to be fairly comfortable, to get some respect and admiration, a taste of a little brief authority and some love, we think we have made a good bargain. We acquiesce in the will to fail. We even pride ourselves on our shrewdness, not suspecting how badly we have been cheated, that we have settled stations of death, not the rewards of life. If the elaborate game that we all play with ourselves and each other never came to an end, never ran down for a moment so that we suddenly saw that it is only a game after all, the will to fail might urge us all gently downhill till we came to rest at its foot, and no one would dream of protesting. But the game has such a way of breaking off sometimes, right at its most amusing spot, and we suddenly wonder why we are running about like this, how we happen to be playing away at hide-and-seek, as if our lives depended on it. What became of the real life we meant to lead while we have been off doing nothing, or busy at the work that provides us with no more than our bread and butter? Sometimes the moment passes, and it is forgotten until long after, if ever remembered at all, but some of us never forget it. If we go on with the game, it turns into a nightmare, and how to wake out of it and get back into reality becomes our whole preoccupation. Then sometimes the nightmare seems to deepen. We try one turn after another, which looks as if it led to freedom, only to find ourselves back in the middle of Alice's looking-glass garden, beginning the hunt all over again. Yet we can escape, and again, rather like Alice, by seeming at first to go backward, by admitting that there may be a real will to fail, and next, that we may be its victims. Writing the direction. In spite of the will to fail, in spite of the rewards of failure, success is the normal aim of man, his proper objective. Energy is correctly used not by spending it to hold ourselves inactive, nor by spurring ourselves to unproductive, sterile activity, but only when it is at the service of the maturest and most comprehensive idea of ourselves that we can arrive at. What this highest idea is will vary from individual to individual, and will expand with growth. No outsider can dictate another's private definition of success. It may, it often does, include some recognition from one's fellows, and greater financial rewards, on the other hand, it may not. Many a researcher in the sciences would consider himself fully successful, and would be right, if he added one minute fact to the mass of accumulating details on which science must proceed. If he took one item out of the realm of hypothesis and speculation, and placed it in its proper relation to the mass of known truths. His name might never be known by those outside his science. It might be quite obscure even within his own field. He would nevertheless have attained the goal for which he was working if he accomplished that which he himself set out to do. The actress who reaches the top of her art is as successful as the mother who raises a large and healthy family, but not more so. A priest or minister immersed in the care of his parish lives as successful a life as the genius whose name is known by most of his contemporaries. Another's ideal of success may have so little in common with our own that we are quite blind as to what he can see in the career he has chosen. But unless we are totally unimaginative, we know, when we see him living responsibly, effectively, usefully, happily, making the most of his advantages and gifts, that we are dealing with a successful man. To offer to circumscribe the definition of success would defeat the purpose of this lecture. Much of our distrust of the word, as it is, comes from not realizing the infinitely extensive range of possible successes. Each of us, usually by late adolescence, has a mass of knowledge about himself, which, if we took the counsel, know thyself seriously, could be examined and considered until the individual's ideal of the good life would emerge from it plainly. It ought to be part of education to see that each child should understand the necessity of finding his clue to his future, and be shown that it is sometimes thrown into confusion by hero worship, or by the erroneous notion that what it is an item in the success of one must be present in the success of each of us. Still, in spite of confusion, false starts, the taking over of the ambitions of a parent or teacher for ourselves instead of finding our own way, most of us do arrive in the early 20s knowing what we are best fitted to do, or could do best if we had the training and opportunity. It is worth noting carefully that unless you have allowed yourself to overestimate your character grossly, your own success idea is within the region of those things which can be brought about. Usually, far from overrating our abilities, we do not understand how great they are. The reason for this underestimation of ourselves will be considered later, but it is well to realize that few except the truly insane believe themselves suited for careers far, far beyond their full powers. The next point to understand is that in this lecture, we are not talking about success of any secondary or metaphorical sort. Your idea of what is success for you is not here to be replaced by another high-sounding idealistic compromise. You are not being exhorted once more to lower your hopes and then find that you can easily reach the simpler standard. Such programs are only temporizing with failure. On the contrary, the more vividly you can present to yourself the original picture of the goal you once hoped to be able to reach, the better your chances are of attaining it. Now, having examined the currents in our nature, which lead us to acquiesce in failure, understanding that, if we allow it to happen, we can be carried unprotestingly down in the deathward direction, let us see what is operating immediately to keep us from the healthy efforts we must make to succeed. To do so, we must turn to a subject which is in some dispute today, hypnotism. For many reasons, some excellent but others suspiciously weak, hypnotism is a subject which is seldom studied nowadays. If you have never had occasion to read a sound book on the subject, it may seem to you that some of the feats claimed by hypnotized persons cannot possibly have been done. There is some likelihood, however, that you have read at least one book on autosuggestion, the method of healing which was so popular about a decade ago. And autosuggestion is one of the byproducts of the 19th century study of hypnotism. But few readers today know of the work, for instance, of Esdale in India in the middle 1800s, of the surgical operations he performed painlessly on hundreds of patients, of his comments on the rapid recovery of those who had felt no pain during the operation, an early contribution to the theory of the deleterious effects of surgical shock. The work of Braid and Bernheim is almost unknown, and Mesmer, who bind a fantastic theory with a mass of arrestingly effective experiments, is now looked on mainly as a quack. There is no doubt that hypnotism is in its present disrepute, partly because its early practitioners could not refrain from premature and fantastic theorizing, and because it became connected in the minds of the public with such subjects as spirit rappings and slate-writing mediums, many of whom were later exposed as tricksters. Possible experimenters were alienated from the subject because it was offered to the world with such unnecessary accompaniments as the hypothesis about otic fluid and animal magnetism, explanation which explained nothing. In addition to these prejudicial theories, experiments in amnesia by the use of chloroform and ether were proceeding in the same years. Insensitiveness to pain reached by hypothesis was uncertain and presented many difficulties. Not everyone was hypnotizable, and, even more important, not every physician was able to hypnotize. Inevitably, the more certain form of attaining anesthesiation through the use of chloroform and ether was the practice which became accepted. The study of hypnotism, which many acute observers of the middle and late 19th century believed to be the first steps towards the freeing of mankind from physical suffering, as well as the overcoming of many temperamental difficulties and the cure of many vices, fell into decline. With the emergence of the psychoanalytic theory, the defeat of hypnotism, at least for our day, was cemented. Now, although the formula that we are about to consider has in it no trace of auto-hypnotism, it is still possible to learn from the despised procedure what it is that defeats us in our efforts to be effective. Consider for a moment the successes of a good hypnotist with a good subject. They sound utterly beyond nature, and for that very reason we have not learned from them all we might garner. One man, ordinarily suffering from vertigo at even a slight eminence, when hypnotized can walk a very narrow plank at a great height. Another, looking slight and delicate, can lift a dead weight. A stammerer can be commanded to give a fervid oration, and will do so without showing a trace of the speech defect which hampers him in his normal state. Perhaps one of the most remarkable cases is one cited by F. W. H. Myers in his chapter on hypnotism in Human Personality. A young actress, an understudy, called upon to suddenly to replace the star of her company, was sick with apprehension and stage fright. Under light hypnosis, she performed with competence and brilliance and won great applause. But it was long before she was able to act her parts without the aid of the hypnotist, who stationed himself in her dressing room. Later in this case, the phenomena of post-hypnotic suggestion began to be observed, and the foundations of the Nancy School of Auto-Suggestion, of which Kuh is the most famous contemporary associate, were laid. In the same chapter in which he quotes the remarkable case of the actress, Myers made a theorizing comment which is of immense value to everyone who hopes to free himself of his bondage of failure. He points out that the ordinary shyness and tentativeness with which we all approach novel action is entirely removed from the hypnotized subject, who consequently acts instead with precision and self-confidence. Now, the removal of shyness, he wrote, which hypnotic suggestion can effect, is in fact a purgation of memory, inhibiting the recollection of previous failures and setting free whatever group of aptitudes is for the moment required. There is the clue. No sentence was ever more packed with rich implications for those who are in the earnest about reorienting their lives towards success. It has become a commonplace to say that we learn by trial and error. We learn by discovering that one course of action does not bring about the end we had in view. We try again, and perhaps many times, until we find the procedure which accomplishes our intention. We then adopt the last term in this series of acts. That is the mental picture we make of the trial and error method of learning. Roughly it is right, but it omits to emphasize one element of the process which, although we may not dwell upon it intentionally, is never forgotten by the unconscious, the element of pain. We believe, or speak, and write as though we believed, that the one success remains as the total residue of the series of attempts, and that it cancels from our minds all the failures which went before it. We do not take into account the tremendous importance of our future conduct of those discarded trials which ended in failure. We succeeded at last, it is true, but meanwhile we experienced failure, sometimes ridicule, sometimes real pain, sometimes grave humiliation. We by no means retain in our memories only the item of the final success, nor does the success operate to make the failures and pain unimportant to our unconscious. The unconscious dreads pain, humiliation, fatigue. It bends its efforts even more ceaselessly to the end of avoiding pain than it does to the procuring of positive pleasures. So we are faced with a fact which at once accounts for much of the inactivity, the inertia, to which we succumb at moments when positive action would be to our advantage, that rather than force the mere possibility of pain, we will not act at all. Rather than revive the memory of our early failures, let alone run the risk of hurting ourselves anew, we will unconsciously decide to remain inactive. Or we will choose to do something easier than we should attempt, or we will start on a program and carry it near the spot where we were hurt before, and there find any excuse to beat a hasty retreat, leaving the work undone, the reward ungathered. The childish unconscious wins. At least we were not bruised again in an already tender spot. It is utterly illogical, of course. In order to avoid a trivial discomfort, we roll up a great account of failure to wound us in the future. We miss opportunity after opportunity, which may never come again. We expose ourselves to far greater pain than that we manage to avoid. But at least the memory of that early humiliation can sleep, or only turn restlessly, half awakened. Now, if that is true, and only a little self-analysis will prove that that is true, how convenient it would be if each of us could carry a hypnotist about to cast a spell whenever we had to get to work. How marvelous if each of us could have his own private Svengali. Impossible, of course, and, more than that, undesirable. Fortunately, it is not all necessary to be put under the sway of another's will in order to do our own work. The solution is far simpler. All that is necessary to break the spell of inertia and frustration is this: act as if it were impossible to fail. That is the talisman, the formula, the command of a right about face which turns us from failure towards success. Clear out, by an easy imaginative feat, all the distrust and timidities, all the fears of looking ridiculous which you may hardly suspect of being treacherous troublemakers in your life. You will find that if you can imaginatively capture the state of mind, which would be yours, if you knew you were going towards a prearranged and inevitable success, the first result will be a tremendous surge of vitality, of freshness. Then, well, the only way to put it is that it will seem as though your mind gave a great sigh of relief, a gratitude for the liberation, and stretched itself to its fullest extent. This is the moment where one may be forgiven for feeling that there is something truly magical about the whole affair. There will appear an extension of capacity which seems more than normal. The long dammed up flow sets in, directly, irresistibly, turned at last in the right direction. The current gathers strength from minute to minute. At first you may still harbor some fear that the spell which works so instantaneous may break in the same way. It will not, simply because it is not a spell. It is a reminder to yourself of the way in which work can always be successfully undertaken. If you remember that, far from your seeing the successful action stop, you will find that each hour of unhampered activity opens out into a promise of others in the future. There may actually be some embarrassment from seeing too many expanding possibilities until you have learned to organize your new life. Those fears, anxieties, and apprehensions you see were far more than mere negative things. By acting as if they were important, you endowed them with importance, you turned them into realities. They became parasitic growths, existing at the expense of everything that is healthy in you. While we allow them to sap us, we are allowing the nourishment which should go towards expanding growth to be used for feeding monsters, cherishing the freaks and byblows of the mind instead of its extraordinary and creative elements. So that it is not that one is suddenly given wonderful new powers by ceasing to let fear hold its frustrating sway. We come into the use of already existing aptitudes which we formerly had no energy to explore. We discover that we already possess capacities we had not suspected, and the effort, of course, is as though we had just received them. And the rapidity with which these capacities make themselves known, when once the aspects are favorable for them, is truly somewhat startling. It is even more enjoyable. Next, there is a further experience of seeming to become, in contrast with one's old self, practically tireless. Actual records of working periods introduced by using this formula would strain the credulity of those who have never yet had the experience, and these periods are not allowed by any depressed reaction. There is always so much ahead, and it is so clearly seen that there is no chance for depression to set in. When the mind is turned back from its onward drive to consider all the tribulations of the past, all the possible mischances which might conceivably happen, it cannot, of course, at the same time explore the road into the future. But at once absolve it of the thankless and unnecessary task, and it rewards you by seeming to fly where before it had stumbled and groped. It takes some self-education to learn how to go from one item of successful work to the next, not to lose time and spend strength, much more happily, but just as surely, in gloating over either the ease with which the task is done, or in contemplating too fondly the truly remarkable work one has just been so fortunate as to produce. But a few days, harvest home, is quite excusable. And since, still resilient and unexhausted, one looks forward to further activity with enjoyment, there is no permanent danger that the first success under the new regime will be the last. If you are tempted to look askance at this procedure, to feel that you are being invited to deceive yourself into a feeling of success, you are quite wrong. We are all pragmatists and empiricists in our daily life. What works for us in our practical truth and becomes the basis of our further activity. Our thoughts become true in proportion as they successfully exert their go-between function, as William James says. And even more fully and convincingly, the late Hans Vaihinger worked out these conceptions in his book, The Philosophy of As If. Not everyone will go with him to the furthest boundaries of his theory, but it is certainly plain that in most matters of life, each of us must act as if this or that fact were a self-evident truth. For one thing, if we insisted on proving the reality or efficacy or even probability of most of the conceptions on which we base our practical procedures, we should have no time left in which to act. So, in general, we accept the premises for action which are presented to us in good authority and use them as proved unless or until our experience causes us to doubt the wisdom of so doing. Then we may re-examine them and perhaps reach different conclusions from our mentors, but for the most part, we all act as if our norms of conduct, our standards of values, were eternally and everywhere valid, so long as they prove practicable for us. In everyday life, then, if you are ineffectual in your daily encounters and unproductive in your work, you are to that extent acting as if you willed to fail. Turn that attitude inside out. Consciously decide that your as-if shall be healthy and vital, shall be aimed towards accomplishment, and you have made success a truth for yourself. The law of nature is, do the thing, and you shall have the power. But they who do not do the thing have not the power.
This segment sponsored by the Personal Development Institute. Please visit them at www.thepdi.com or www.personaldevelopmentinstitute.com. Thank you for listening. Have a great day. Bye for now.
Success Live with the Reverend Donald Gordon Carty, Ph.D.